Okay, good morning everyone. So this morning there's still some questions left over from yesterday, and people we thought it would be use the morning to this morning session to go over a few more of the questions. There's actually there's one of the monks at Abhayagiri has he is very sweet, Ajahn Kachana. last year I was in he's been in England the last several years, and helping out there. And anyway, he was saying that no, Ajahn, you know, your talks are really good, but you know, actually where you really shine is with question and answers. And he said, would you mind if I compiled your questions and answers and made it available on our website? And so he and a couple other monks have been working on a whole database of years of questions and answers from different retreats, and trying to get topics so people can actually look them up and research it. It's still in the beta version. But I just got an email yesterday that they're getting very close, and it's starting it up. So that should be something that'll be available on our website. When I go inward, I don't feel or experience brightness. Instead, I feel heavy. How can I get to that brightness? Well, I mean, I think, you know, there's a variety of things that are, I think, and one aspect to be considering is not how to get brightness, but how to relinquish the obstacles to brightness. 'Cause so often what we want is, you know, I mean, who doesn't want brightness? But it's sort of, it's like trying to squeeze it out of a rock sometimes, and just to be able to those five hindrances yesterday are really a major source of what clouds the mind in all sorts of different ways. So by attending to, you know, what are the obstacles, what are the things that tend to, yeah, sully the mind, stain the mind, obstruct awareness, then you find a lot of space opens up, rather than, you know, trying. Because sometimes you can say, well, certainly aspects of faith and devotion are bright, or those recollections of generosity and virtue are bright, and that's really helpful to be doing, rather than sort of like focusing on a particular technique and trying to, you know, waiting for the brightness to come, sort of thing, but more really being attentive to the, well, what does the mind obsess over? What does the mind get caught in? What does it get hooked by? And how can I relinquish that? How can I let go of that? How can I create some space around that? That's what I would suggest. So were there some online ones as well? Okay. We can maybe do that. Ah, okay. When one is caught in depression or negativity, how can one brighten or uplift the mind? So, I mean, there's a that's an but you know, sometimes with depression and negativity, I mean, there's a slightly different. You know, if you're really getting then sort of going to the obstacles, it can be more depressing. So it's I think it's important that one, okay, there's negativity and depression here. There should be more conscious effort toward, and something like generosity is so important for helping depression. It's realizing that I can do something, I can be generous, I can be kind, and recollecting that, remembering that, as well as putting attention onto it. And those aspects of virtue and integrity, and that sense that, you know, because oftentimes people, you know, I feel so down, don't feel good about myself, you know, so, you know, and just, well, you know, have you killed anybody today? You haven't robbed any banks or anything. So, you know, that's pretty good. It's a good start. Yeah. So oftentimes our bar is so you know, hopelessly idealistic. Would you be willing to share memories of Ajahn Chah? Well, I mean, it's always nice to have an Ajahn Chah story. But, you know, I think, maybe one of the things is before I ever met Ajahn Chah, the monastery that I was at was a city monastery. And I was there as a layperson, and then I took what I thought was a temporary ordination, just to give it a try. And there were some handwritten notes of somebody who'd been to Wat Pa Phong, to Ajahn Chah's monastery, and one of them was a story of Ajahn Chah, a teaching that somebody gave, and they came where they and the person was, you know, probably somebody was educated or had some fair bit of knowledge of Buddhism, and you know, you get these things sometimes with say as a teacher, where people are you know, come to sort of test your knowledge. And somebody came and asked Ajahn Chah, you know, what is the essential teaching in Buddhism? What is the core essence of the Buddhist teachings? And Ajahn Chah sort of looked at the guy, and then he picked up, say, something like this, because, is this a big stick or a little stick? and the person is sort of, he's, you know, testing, he's wanting philosophy, and then he's this Ajahn Chah's asking about this stick, and he said, I don't understand. He said, well, If you wanted to build a house, you'd call this a little stick. And if you wanted to clean your teeth, pick your teeth after the meal, you call this a big stick. So what you call something and how you conceive of things is completely dependent on desire. That's the essence of the Buddhist teachings. Is desire is the cause of suffering. And so it's just an illustration that made it very real, but was definitely on the mark. Something that comes to mind for me, say personally, because I did have the good fortune to live and train with him for quite a few years, and then I lived quite close to him as he was getting sick and then was sick, bedridden, unable to speak. So it was very much a part of the crew helping out. So I had a long association with Ajahn Chah. But one time, say as a youngish monk, I was a few years, I'd been a monk for a few years, and so my language was getting better, and then a city monk who I had met before, and in my opinion was insufferable. And then he came with another Westerner who was, I think he was Swedish, a journalist. And then the monk was sort of asking the questions for the journalist, and I'd had a couple interactions before this all took place, like in Bangkok, and I found him irritating, and I was not very skillful in my covering that up at all. In my mind, I was kind of quite dismissive of the person, which is not a beautiful mind state. So after the meal, we went and sat with Ajahn Chah, and the journalist had his question explained that he was working for a magazine that was kind of like a spiritual magazine, and he was going around to these different teachers, Buddhist, Hindu, Christian, if you can find them, and then asking them three questions, and it was a how do you practice? Oh no. Why do you practice? How do you practice? What is the result of the practice? And so that why do you practice was the first. Why do you practice? Why do you engage in any religious activity, religious training, spiritual training? So he asked the question, and again, the context is me having a lot of views and opinions about this person, which is then seeped into the journalist, and so and I was sort of kind of dismissive, and so then I translated for Ajahn Chah, you know, like, why do you practice? How do you practice? What results do you get from the practice? And then Ajahn Chah sort of talked about this, talked about that, asked some questions from the person, and so I'm translating back and forth. And then it was, and then he was, huh, what were those questions? So then I had to repeat, so I had to go over the questions again. And I said, why do you practice? How do you practice? Okay. And then he goes off in another tangent. And he chats about this and chats about that. So. And he goes, and he said, Pastor, what were those questions again? So then I have to go through it again. And again, he sort of just talking about something completely different. And the other people are getting a bit irritated, and I'm understand Lumpon is putting the screws on me. and then he comes back. And again, you know, what was this question? And he said, call the novice over. Get a piece of paper for me. Okay, what was that first one? Okay, why do you practice? How do you? So then he gets it written, nicely written down. And and he looks up at the, at the monk who was doing the talking for the journalist. And said, in Thai, he said, Kin khao tamai. And said, why do you eat? And then the person was kind of flummoxed and said, I don't know, why do you eat? And then Lumpa went, you eat because you're hungry. And in the same way, the heart is hungry for some kind of understanding, some kind of clarity. And when you really understand and recognize that hunger for something that's true, that's good, that's peaceful, that's clear, then you'll find a way to practice. You'll look. And then for the result that you get from the practice is in the same way that when you eat, you're full. You're full. You feel better. You feel good. So that's the same. That's why we practice in these spiritual teachings and these religious teachings, is in order to one is to give some ease from that hunger, but also to feel comfortable, to feel at ease. So that was Ajahn. But it was, so much of the, he could be such a drama. he was a great actor. So it was really, it was very memorable. It was burned into my memory. And the same, he'd do different things too. he because he wasn't really fixed, and he didn't really. And again, this is where the beauty of non-self really shows through. Is you don't have to carry a persona. Like he could kind of be the forgetful old monk and not be at all sort of embarrassed it was useful to do that, to be that role, and it highlighted the teaching that he was giving. But he was also, oftentimes when we tell these stories, it's kind of his ebullient personality that sort of shines through. But really, I think one of the main reasons why I stayed with him and lived with him and was inspired by him was the tremendous sense of, firmness or unshakability that he exuded. And it's actually, I came across was in the letters I mean, Kathy's been working on some of the transcription, but whatever I sent home to my family, as I sent all sorts of things, as you know, pictures and whatnot, but all the letters, my mom kept them all, unbeknownst to me. I had no idea that she'd kept them all. And last year she asked if I wanted them, and I was sort of, and there's some people in working on a biography of mine, so well, that would probably be useful for a biography. There might be some good information. I have no idea what I wrote to my family. And one of the letters was, I'd probably been at Wat Pa Pong and Wat Nana Chat maybe for about a year. So that was my second year of being a monk, maybe for about a year. And I'm describing to my family and my mother and my parents what life is like there. It's quite a long letter. And but then also my, because when I very first ordained, I mentioned it was a temporary ordination, I figured maybe 3 months, four tops. I mean, surely I can figure this out in that long. And but my time is extending and I'm staying on, and I'm writing to my parents and sort of saying, you know, describing the community, but really the main reason is because of Ajahn Chah, as a teacher, as a person, as a human being. There's something about him that is compelling, and he is peaceful and solid and clear and unshakable in the midst of all that's going around him. And I would like to be somewhat like something like that. So this is Ajahn Chah's inspiration. Okay, I could go on and on. What is your opinion of the secular mindfulness movement, MBSR and its associated programs? Can mindfulness serve a useful function for people without the rest of the Dhamma? Well, absolutely. I mean, it's introduced so many people to one, just to skillful tools for living a better life. But then it's also for those who are interested. And you, people who've started, have been practicing it, they're developing it. So there's got to be a, where did this come from? You know, and then it opens up a doorway into Buddhism if they're interested. But so it's you know, I see it serving immense benefit, and has, so that. Yeah, I don't, I'm, you know, I live in a very, secluded monastery with a part of a very, quote unquote, strict tradition. But, you know, we're not really purists or, you know, sort of that in the sense that you can't understand the bigger picture. Because what, you know, the rest of the Dhamma is there for anybody who wants it. And there are resources and there are good examples. And those will, I think, continue to grow. But, you know, there's a lot of seeds need to be planted. And so that's one of this, the secular mindfulness movement, you know, does provide that. I mean, it's got its own flaws and limitations. But it's, you know, as with everything, it's also sort of changing and morphing and maturing and growing as well. Please, a short talk on Nibbana. Thank you. That's hilarious. Yeah. Well, just the Nibbana is not a thing. there's two different ways that the Buddha described Nibbana. Nibbana is the cessation of suffering. Nibbana is the cessation of greed, hatred, delusion. And it's interesting that what the apt way to describe Nibbana is through the cessation of that which is an obstacle. And again, and this is what is pointing to, okay, how do you access brightness? Well, for the most part, it's through relinquishing that which is not bright. And because as soon as you try to make that brightness sort of manifest or appear, or make Nibbana sort of manifest and appear, it crumbles in front of your eyes. It's just the way reality sort of works. There's a teaching that the Buddha gives throughout the suttas, and it's a short phrase for anybody interested in learning Pali. It's yena yena himanyati sato tang hoti anyata. But for however one conceives it, it is always other than that. And that's how the mind works. It's how reality. So as soon as you start conceiving of, I've got to get that brightness, or I've got to achieve Nibbana. Or I got Nibbana. it crumbles, or it recedes into the distance. So that the way to approach it is through relinquishment. And it's through that relinquishment that is, and of course within that relinquishment you're cultivating all sorts of skillful, wholesome qualities, like a glimpse into Nibbana is through the jhanas, the experience of these refined mental states. It's not Nibbana, but it's a glimpse. You get a bit of a glimmer of what the possibilities are. But that settling of the mind, stilling of the mind, relinquishing that which is a source of dukkha, there's you're starting to get a taste, get a flavor. Like the Buddha saying that there is just the taste of dhamma is the taste of freedom.
Yeah. Mention your book.
Hmm?
Mention your book then. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I've got happened. Yeah. I didn't think of that. Chittasubha said to there is a book called The Island, and it's written by Ajahn Amaro and myself, and it's about Nibbana. So. I've been told it's a good book.
Judy is willing to read questions from online.
Okay, very good.
Judy, go ahead when you're ready.
Okay, they can go ahead with asking questions from the online group.
Hello, thank you for taking our questions. I'm going to read aloud a couple questions that our Zoom participants entered. The first one is, thank you so much for being here and giving such a beautiful retreat experience. I'm wondering if you might talk a bit about what exactly is reborn in Buddhist teachings.
Okay. Well, what is reborn is desire. That's the we're fundamentally a bundle of desire. And of course those desires are, you know, for sensual desire, sensory gratification, stimulation, but then also the desire for being and becoming, and the desire for non-being. Don't like it, shouldn't be this way. Those desires are what are the impetus for the mind stream to land. And you can see, you don't need to wait to die and get reborn to see that. Because that's what keeps motivating us, moving us, generating what we do, where we go, how we feel about things. That is what is reborn from moment to moment. So you can see this process happening all the time. And just the ability of the mind, the fundamental ability of the mind to know consciousness, that lands on an object, its object of desire. And whether it's a desire of attraction or aversion, it's still a desire. And we are born into that, and we land there, and then we keep moving. So you land, and your feet are still moving. So that's just the nature of existence. But that's the whole point of say the Buddhist teaching is that non-identification with the desire process, and when one can actually relinquish it, one can let it go. It's not that we don't do anything or engage in any way, but it doesn't recreate itself in the process. So that's what how I would answer it off the top of my head.
Thank you. A question from yesterday that is, I guess, kind of related to the last one, so maybe you could just add a little bit if there's something to add, was a question about the Metta Sutta and the lines, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. And the question was to comment on that last phrase, not born again into this world, and what that, on the meaning of that.
Yes, I mean, that's the beauty of the Metta Sutta, is it's kind of really warm and fuzzy all the way through, and then all of a sudden, what do you mean? I'm not reborn again. I'm not born again. Oh dear. What did I get tricked into this meta stuff? So, the Buddha is giving a complete path. When we think of metta, oftentimes we think of, quite rightly, as I was saying, that mature emotion, the divine abiding of a state of heart that is really is quite bright and spacious. loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. These are very bright states. But the Metta Sutta begins with how do you lay it starts from A and goes to Z, and that this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness, should be able and upright. And so it's for the first quarter or third of the sutta doesn't really address the metta really at all. But it's metta doesn't exist in a vacuum. It has to have that context of skillfulness and wise attention to action, how we relate to other human beings, how we live in the world with others, and laying that foundation really solidly. Then you start directing attention to those aspects of, you know, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease, this expansive wish for everyone's well-being. And then that sense of even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. These are very tender emotions, very bright, very caring. But then the arc of the whole path of Buddhism, you know, if you think in terms of you're beginning with sila, samadhi, banya, and insight, and the fruition of insight is liberation. So that it's that relinquishment of that, because the heart is so full and has been purified of the sense, because that's another aspect of, say, like of metta. For as it becomes more and more mature, then the sense of self drops away, the sense of me being so kind and warm, and it drops away, and it really reaches a place of brightness and or as I mentioned in the I don't know whether it was a talk or a Q&A, one of them, where Ajahn Mahabua asked, you know, what's the mind of an arahant like? And his immediate response, only compassion, only compassion. And so that's purification. But then of course, the nature of the arahant is that they are completely selfless. So that by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, because that's, again, views and opinions are one of the obstacles, because you can, similarly, you can be developing a lot of metta and karuna and what, but, you know, the views are really strong, so that the relinquishing of the obstacles to the Brahma Viharas, then relinquishing the limitations in terms of views and opinions, and that is the doorway into an ending of the round of rebirths. And so that Metta Sutta, it is a lovely sutta that definitely makes one, you know, it's uplifting and brightening. But it is interesting to see, as in many of the teachings of the Buddha takes you on an arc from the beginning right through to the end. And the Metta Sutta is a great example of that. Anything else?
Thank you. There were a few questions from yesterday that didn't get saved, so I just want to invite anyone in the Zoom, if your question was not addressed, please feel free to raise your hand and ask.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, I think we've covered our bases. People don't have any more questions now.